We are very happy to continue our study in the book of Romans. We're still in the 12th chapter of Romans and in the midst of the 8th verse. In this passage, the Apostle Paul is teaching the church at Rome about the various offices that were in the church and the gifts or the miraculous powers that were associated with these offices. And so beginning to read from the 4th verse, "For as we have many members in one body, and all members have not the same office, so we, being many, are one body in Christ, and every one members one of another. Having then gifts differing according to the grace that is given to us, whether prophecy, let us prophesy according to the proportion of faith, or ministry, let us wait on our ministering, or he that teacheth on teaching, or he that exhorteth on exhortation, he that giveth, let him do it with simplicity, he that ruleth with diligence, he that showeth mercy with cheerfulness." And so we're in the midst of this 8th verse, and we've already discussed the offices that have to do with exhorting and giving. Now we're going to talk about the office of he that ruleth. He says, "He that ruleth with diligence." The New International Version says that this means to have leadership or governing. So whether as elders and deacons in the church or as parents at home, they were to use this office with a spirit of zealous attention to the work for which they were responsible, not with any desire to lord it over others or gain personal enrichment or for personal glory. Now we have this position of ruling being referred to in several other passages, and we'd like to refer to some of those and read from them. In 1 Timothy 3, verses 3 through 6, there he's talking about the qualifications of an elder, and he says, "Not given to wine, no striker, not greedy of filthy lucre, but patient, not a brawler, not covetous, one that ruleth well his own house, having his children in subjection with all gravity. For if a man know not how to rule his own house, how shall he take care of the church of God?" So this tells us that one of the qualifications for an elder was that he be able to rule his own house. So ruling here is not only in the church, but it's also done in the home. And it means to have the ability to oversee and to lead those that would be under this authority. Again, we have in 1 Thessalonians 5, 12 and 13, "And we beseech you, brethren, to know them that labor among you and are over you in the Lord and admonish you, and to esteem them very highly in love for their work's sake, and be at peace among yourselves." So here Paul is talking to Thessalonians about a group of people who were over you in the Lord. That is, they had this ruling capacity, and this has to refer to these offices of apostles and prophets and evangelists and bishops or and deacons. He says to know them, to esteem them very highly in love for their work's sake, and to be at peace among yourselves. Again, in 1 Timothy 5:17, "Let the elders that rule well be counted worthy of double honor, especially they who labor in the word and doctrine." So here we read of the elders actually having the responsibility of ruling, and the ones that rule well, he says, are to be counted worthy of double honor. That is, not only the honor of being in the office of elder, but quite possibly of being paid for their time and their labor. Again, in 1 Peter 5, 1 through 4, talking about the elders, he says, "The elders which are among you I exhort, who am also an elder, and a witness of the sufferings of Christ, and also a partaker of the glory that shall be revealed. Feed the flock of God which is among you, taking the oversight thereof, not by constraint, but willingly, not for filthy lucre, but of a ready mind. Neither as being lords over God's heritage, but being examples to the flock. And when the chief shepherd shall appear, ye shall receive a crown of glory that fadeth not away." Now this is talking to the elders about their position of being rulers, but he tells how to do it. Not to be lording it over others, but to do it willingly, not by constraint, not for money. That's the motivation and the attitude that those who occupy the office of elder were to have. Again, in 1 Timothy 3 and 12, "Let the deacons be the husbands of one wife, ruling their children and their own houses well." So again, to be a deacon, you had to have this ability to rule in the home, as well as be able to then take on the responsibilities that a deacon would have in the church. And one of the proving grounds for his ability to do well in the church in that regard would be how well he did in the home in the area of ruling. Those that were in the position of ruling had a very responsible job, a very responsible area, and he says to do it with diligence. Now, as we continue in the 8th verse of Romans 12, the next office and the next gift we have given is that of mercy. He says, "He that showeth mercy with cheerfulness." A good example of mercy is given in Matthew 25, 35 through 36, where Jesus says, "For I was an hungered, and you gave me meat. I was thirsty, and you gave me drink. I was a stranger, and you took me in. Naked, and you clothed me. I was sick, and you visited me. I was in prison, and you came unto me." To have mercy means actually to care for the sick and infirm, the aged and the needy, not so much to provide financial support, but to attend them in their affliction and take care of them. As the deacon had the duty of distributing financial and personal goods, others had the duty of giving personal care. This may not be an office in the technical sense, yet they were probably assigned to this duty by the church and requested to perform it, and the Apostle Paul mentions it here as though it were an office, having special miraculous gifts to attend it. There were no hospitals or nursing homes at the time this was written, and these institutions do not take away our responsibility today in giving personal attendance to the needy. Christians have always felt it their duty to give personal care to the sick and needy, and so important was this function that here we have general instructions given to the church. Now he says to do this with cheerfulness. He that showeth mercy with cheerfulness. Those who distributed to the needy were to do it with simplicity, with an honest aim to meet the purpose for which it was entrusted to them. And just so, those who show mercy are to do it with cheerfulness, pleasantness, and joy. Nothing will enhance the value of personal care given to the sick and afflicted as much as a kind, pleasant attitude. If anywhere a mild, friendly, cheerful, and patient disposition is needed, it's near a sick bed when helping those in need. If impatience, fretfulness, grumbling, or a begrudging attitude is sensed to be in us, it will pain those whom we seek to benefit, and it will make our service of comparatively little value. The needy and infirm, feeble and aged, sick and distressed, have enough to bear without the impatience and harshness of best friends. Jesus Christ set a great example for us in this regard. Though constantly surrounded by the infirm and afflicted, yet he was always kind and gentle and mild, giving to us the perfect example of this command, "He that showeth mercy with cheerfulness." We have other scriptures that bear this out. And for example, in 2 Corinthians 9 and 11, they're talking about giving, he says, "Every man according as he purposeth in his heart, so let him give, not grudgingly, or necessity, for God loveth a cheerful giver." So just as those who give are to give with this attitude, even so those who show mercy, those who attend to the needs of those who have need, they're to have the same attitude, not being doing it grudgingly, not doing it as a necessity of those they have to, but with cheer. And just as God loves the cheerful giver, we know that he also loves those who bestow mercy in a cheerful manner. So in these past 5 verses of this 12th chapter of Romans, we have been given an account of the establishment, the order, and duties of different members of the church in relation to the miraculous gifts. They were not to despise the rank which God had assigned them, and not to think of themselves more highly than they ought, but to carry out each one's individual office or function using the gifts God had given them. Although we today do not have these miraculous gifts, the work of the church members must still be carried out, and the principles which apply to the church at Rome still apply to us today. Beginning with the 9th verse of this 12th chapter of Romans, the Apostle Paul now begins to name some general Christian duties. The first one he names is love. Verse 9 says, "Let love be without dissimulation. Abhor that which is evil. Cleave to that which is good." He says, "Let love be without dissimulation." The word dissimulation means hypocrisy. This is the first Christian duty named in this series of Christian duties now. He is going to refer to the subject of love again in this and the next chapter. Here the word love refers to the attitude we should have towards mankind in general. We have a definition of love given in Romans 3, verse 10. There he says, love worketh no ill to his neighbor. The New International Version states this, does no harm to its neighbor. This means that we should conduct ourselves in such a way as to bring no harm to anyone. Every action of ours is included in this. Our thoughts, words, deeds, and attitudes are all geared to bring no harm to anyone. So love is an intelligent act rather than just an emotional feeling. A person must know what God's will is to be able to truly know how to practice love. Anything that is sin or that it causes or encourages another to sin is not love. This love must be sincere or genuine, without hypocrisy. He says without dissimulation. It is never just a show or a pretended feeling, but it's the true feeling of the Christian. This is truly Christian love, and only a genuine Christian can possess this kind of love. Then he further says in the ninth verse, abhor that which is evil. The word abhor means to hate, turn from, or avoid. The word evil has reference to malice or unkindness rather than to evil in general. And this is simply another way of teaching Christian love. That is, you must have an aversion to anything that is contrary to love, such as malice or unkindness. So not only do we have a command to have love, we have a command against that which is not love. We're to have an attitude that is absolutely turned against anything that will be a non-act of love. He further says in the ninth verse, cleave to that which is good. So not only do we abhor that which is evil, but we cleave to that which is good. The word cleave means gluing or uniting firmly with glue. It means a very firm adherence to an object. The good referred here to is that which pertains to the love of all mankind. Hence, the Christian should be firmly attached to that which is good and not be separate from it. This is not occasional or irregular, but constant, active, positive love. So this ninth verse is truly teaching that we should have love for all mankind in general. We should stay away from those things that would tend to bring about any kind of harm, anything that would be contrary to love, and we should cleave to that. We should adhere to that principle, that type of action that's going to be the showing of true love to all mankind. Our next verse in the 12th chapter of Romans, verse 10, says, be kindly affectioned one to another with brotherly love, in honor preferring one another. This statement, be kindly affectioned one to another with brotherly love. Kindly affection is the kind of feeling that close members of a family should have for each other. These feelings are among the closest that humans can have for each other. And these are the kind of feelings that members of the church have for each other. In 1 Peter 2:17, there Peter says, honor all men, love the brotherhood, fear God, honor the king. Brotherly love is love to the brethren. So it says, be kindly affectioned one to another with brotherly love. This is the kind of love we have for the brethren. As close as this relationship of being kindly affectioned is, it is still to be mingled with brotherly love. This describes the most enduring relationship attainable among persons on this earth. In John 13:35, by this shall all men know that you're my disciples if you have love one to another. That's the way Jesus describes this. So we're to have this love that is so obvious, not a show or a pretense, but it's obviously and genuinely there that all men can know that you're my disciples, he says, if you have love one to another. Now, the last part of this 10th verse says, in honor preferring one another. The statement in honor really is the giving of honor to another and not seeking honor for ourselves. Preferring one another means to strive to give honor to others in the church rather than receiving honor for ourselves. So he says, in honor, preferring one another, we prefer to give each other honor rather than to receive honor for ourselves. This attitude is true humility and will always lead away from pride or haughtiness. In 1 Peter 5:5, he says, likewise, ye younger, submit yourselves unto the elder, yea, all of you be subject one to another, and be clothed with humility, for God resisteth the proud, and giveth grace to the humble. Again in Ephesians 5:21, submitting yourselves one to another in the fear of God. 1 John 4:20-21, if a man say, I love God, and hateth his brother, he is a liar. For he that loveth not his brother whom he hath seen, how can he love God whom he hath not seen? And this commandment have we from him, that he who loveth God love his brother also. So John is simply saying, if we don't love our brother, we really don't have a brother to love, because it disqualifies us from being in the family of God. We can't love God unless we also love our brother. Philippians 2:3, let nothing be done through strife or vainglory, but in lowliness of mind, let each esteem other better than themselves. So we move into Romans 12:11 now. Not slothful in business, fervent in spirit, serving the Lord. Let's look first at this phrase of not slothful in business. The word slothful means slow, idle, not prompt, sluggish mentally and physically. The New International Version describes it as lacking in zeal. As we look at the word business, we see that in verse 8, this word is translated as diligence. There it says, he that ruleth with diligence. It indicates haste, industry, intensity, and labor. It does not refer to any particular occupation, but is used in a general sense to refer to all the labor which we have to do. We're to be faithful and industrious as we go about our designated duties. The Lord Jesus Christ was constantly employed with performing the duties of his life. Idleness and Christianity are names which do not go together. Every Christian has enough to do to occupy all of his time. He whose life is spent in ease has reason to doubt how faithful he is in devotion to God. God has assigned us much to accomplish, and he will hold us answerable for the faithful doing of it. In Ecclesiastes 9:10, whatsoever thy hand findeth to do, do it with thy might. For there is no work, nor device, nor knowledge, nor wisdom in the grave whither thou goest. He's simply saying, we only have this life to accomplish our work in. After we leave this life, we cannot come back and do any of the work here to be done on earth. There's none to be done in the grave whither thou goest. As we think of this idea of not being slothful in business, it reminds us of the parable that Jesus gives in Matthew 25, and Matthew 25, verses 14 through 30. Let's read that. For the kingdom of heaven is as a man traveling into a far country, who calls his own servants and delivered unto them his goods. And unto one he gave 5 talents, to another 2, and to another 1, to every man according to his several ability, and straightway took his journey. Then he that had received the 5 talents went and traded with the same, and made them other 5 talents. And likewise he that had received 2, he also gained other 2. But he that had received 1 went and digged in the earth, and hid his Lord's money. After a long time, the Lord of those servants cometh, and he reckoneth with them. And so he that had received the 5 talents came and brought other 5 talents, saying, Lord, thou deliverest unto me 5 talents. Behold, I have gained besides them 5 talents more. And his Lord said unto him, well done, thou good and faithful servant. Thou hast been faithful over a few things. I will make thee ruler over many things. Enter thou into the joy of thy Lord. He also that had received 2 talents came and said, Lord, thou deliverest unto me 2 talents. Behold, I have gained 2 other talents beside them. His Lord said unto him, well done, good and faithful servant. Thou hast been faithful over a few things. I will make thee ruler over many things. Enter into the joy of thy Lord. Then he which received the 1 talent came and said, Lord, I knew thee that thou art a hard man, reaping where thou hast not sown, and gathering where thou hast not strawed. And I was afraid, and went and hid thy talent in the earth. Lo, there thou hast that is thine. His Lord answered and said unto him, thy wicked and slothful servant, thou knewest that I reaped where I sowed not, and gathered where I had not strawed. Thou oughtest therefore to have put my money into the exchangers, and then at my coming I should have received mine own with usury. Take therefore the talent from him, and give it unto him which hath 10 talents. For unto every one that hath shall be given, and he shall have abundance, but from him that hath not shall be taken away even that which he hath. and cast ye the unprofitable servant into outer darkness, there shall be weeping and gnashing of teeth. Now, as we look at this parable, we see that it wasn't how much money was given that was counted here. It was what they did with what they received. The man who received 2 talents and brought 2 talents more received as much as the man who received 10 talents and brought 10 talents more, because each was given according to his servile ability. But the one who received 1 talent and did nothing with it but just hide it, then he is called an unprofitable servant. He is called a wicked and slothful servant, the very thing we're talking about in our verse in Romans. Be not slothful in business. This man was slothful. And so the Lord took that talent away which he had, and he gave it to the man who had 10 talents. And where the other 2 were told to enter into the joys of thy Lord, this man was said to be cast into outer darkness. There should be weeping and gnashing of teeth. So let us take our responsibilities, our duties in this life, and be not slothful in business, but be industrious in carrying them out, whatever they may be. That concludes our lesson at this time. This is N.C. Crouch saying, goodbye, friends. State of unhappiness David had to be in as a result of his enemies. The waves of death, the floods of ungodly men, the sorrows of hell, and the snares of death. These are the problems that he had. Very real, pressing problems, threats to his life, things that would give him a lot of distress, a lot of anxiety, a lot of grief, things that would cause him to not be able to think on the pleasant, mundane, everyday affairs of this life, but he was continually having to be on the lookout for his very life as though a